May it please the court. Unlike the federal Constitution, the Texas Constitution contains no supremacy clause. Instead, Article 11, Section 5 does the opposite. It endows home rule cities like Houston with the full power of self-government, limited only by a local enactment's direct conflict with state law. Consequently, when the Texas legislature, which then included the current mayor of Houston, unanimously passed Section 113.054 of the Texas Natural Resources Code, it essentially codified for the LPG industry the Texas Constitution's existing home rule conflict exception when it provided that the existing rules and standards promulgated by the Commission preempted corresponding local laws. Indeed, this limited view of the conflict has been embraced by the Railroad Commission itself in its own proposed rules to implement Section 113.054. The essential part of the statute, however, is its second sentence, which recognizes local government's co-regulation of propane by empowering them to tailor propane regulations to their city's individual safety needs by petitioning the Railroad Commission's executive director for permission to enact rules and standards that are more restrictive. There is no hint in this record that the unanimous Texas legislature would have passed the first sentence of Section 113.054 without the second. Nevertheless, TPGA not only asked these courts effectively to sever these provisions and enforce only the first, but more importantly today, it demands that the court do so without TPGA satisfying the threshold jurisdictional requirements or even applying the ordinary statutory construction principles that apply in cases like this.
Even if the focus is on that second provision, though, isn't the city in a hole because they don't really have anything to point to show that they've had approval for a more restrictive ordinance?
Well, our contention is that they don't need it. There's not a process to do that. In the ripeness section of our brief, we talk specifically about the fact that there is no procedure. For example, even if we had wanted to go under the proposed rules, the infrastructure for those proposed rules, the forms that they reference in the first paragraph, Form 26, isn't on the website. So
does that just render the second provision meaningless? Do we write that out of the statute?
Because that's essentially what TPGA would like to do. And we argue in our brief, and I'll argue here today, that's not the way that you ever interpret a statute. You have to apply severance principles. You have to apply statutory construction principles. There's nothing special about this provision that allows TPGA or this court to enforce the first part without the second. And if the court would like, I can turn to that issue first. It's really undisputed that the RRC has established this no process at all. We have gone to the Railroad Commission. Mr. Valenti's affidavit specifically says we went there in 2018, and in 2018 they told us keep doing what you're doing. And I think that's in part because, again, the Railroad Commission has taken the position that you have to identify an existing regulation with the in the RRC, one in the local law, see if they conflict, and if so, then you have a threshold requirement. You've at least triggered the statute, and then the city has to show at some point, and we don't really know how that happens because there's no rules that tell us exactly what the standard of proof is.
But the statute seems to put that burden on the city.
Well, it would put it on the city if there were any processes. But as we've said in our brief, cases from out of state, ordinary statutory construction principles, severance principles, all point to putting the burden of the absence of standards, the absence of a process to get the kind of formal approval that TPGA would recognize. I mean, part of the problem that we have is they want some sort of Goldilocks solution that says that we have gotten a formal approval through an informal process. And I'm not sure that anything we would have done would have satisfied them, because their view is and remains that somehow this provision, which the plain language does not support, that this provision somehow wipes out every regulation that governs propane, including those it doesn't even bother to challenge in the building and plumbing codes, and we have to sort of recreate it through the Railroad Commission. That is not the position that the Railroad Commission has taken. That is not the position that any preemption principle that I've recognized in 15 years of doing basically preemption work applies in this case. That's not the thing. What the Railroad Commission provision does is basically to say that if you have an existing rule, you want to enact a new rule, you go and you try to get that approved, but there's no process. And so under Texas law, because there is no process, because there have been no regulations promulgated, you can't enforce the first provision, which is this sort of neutron bomb approach that TPGA wants, without affording the cities the rights that were afforded. Part of the reason that I tried to set the table a bit at the beginning on, you know, how the laws work is because this idea that you can separate these two provisions, including the one that gives the city rights to come in and make its case, can't be separated when you have no vehicle for allowing the city to assert its rights in any meaningful way.
So under that argument, is 113.054 wholly meaningless?
Well, for now, it hasn't been fully implemented. And that's ordinarily the way that statutes are interpreted. You know, if the court says, I mean, for example, if a court says that we are going to enforce the first sentence and we don't really care if Houston has the ability to go to the Railroad Commission, you defy the Bennett case, the Supreme Court's Bennett's case that we cite in our reply brief at page 11, that you can only enforce a provision if it cannot be presumed that the legislature would have passed the first sentence without the second. TPGA has not even attempted to meet that standard, and I would suggest that that standard can't be met in this case. There's no evidence to suggest that that would be the case. So in fact, TPGA, excuse me.
If I may, so is it the city's position that the regulations are totally unenforceable unless and until the Railroad Commission puts some formal process in place?
Well, there are no regulations. That's the problem. There is no process whatsoever.
What I'm asking is it your position that you can't enforce this section 113 unless the Railroad Commission says, city, this is how you petition something to us. First you send a letter, then you have 30 days to explain something like that.
Right, because what we've done, I mean, we're caught between a rock and a hard place. We have gone to the commission and said, all right, we're laying them all out on the table. Here's what we've got. What do we do with that? And as Mr. Valenti's affidavit states, as late as 2018, nobody has ever said, I'm sorry, all of your things are wiped out. Go forth and you know, sin no more. What they've done is say, you're fine. And they've effectively taken the position that everything in the past is grandfathered, and they may take a look at a proposed bunch of rules if there's a counterpart at the state level. But there is nothing in Texas law, there is nothing that TPGA has raised that suggests that this sort of neutron bomb, that everything is wiped out, even if there is no state counterpart, takes place. And second, there's not a principle that they have latched onto that would allow this kind of dual enforcement. The risk of the failure to implement is on the state and on TPGA. It is not on the city. And that, I think, that's probably the most important thing that I would like for the court to remember. Under Texas law, that's what the Bennett case says. It is up to them to show that the legislature would allow the separation of the two. It is up to them to show that the simply saying, well, Houston loses out, does not so expand the first sentence that it really undermines the whole statute. It is up to them to show that the Code Construction Act is satisfied where it says that you can't read a statute to essentially nullify a provision. It is up to them to show that the cases that Houston cited from other states, from Colorado and from New York, where they faced exactly this situation where there has been a failure to put in implementing regulations and they said, we will not enforce the statute, a case is not ripe until you do that. We're not saying that they never get to do this, but we are saying that the case is not ripe until they do.
Ms. Pell, I apologize that we're interrupting you, but you're going pretty quick. We're having a hard time squeezing in questions.
I understand that.
What other than the affidavit from Mr. Valenti is in the record that shows us, you know, documents the efforts that have been made in the Railroad Commission side of things? I noticed they're not in the case anymore.
We had a number of affidavits. We had an affidavit from Mr. Valenti, an affidavit from Ms. Chang, who talked about the meetings that they had with the Railroad Commission. And I think it's important here to look.
Any petitions, orders, anything that's like a formal?
No, because there's nothing that was really offered. And that's the problem, is
By the Railroad Commission?
Offered by the Railroad Commission. I mean, we've sort of said, what is it? You tell us what it is we need. And they've not offered anything. Now, I mean, we have a problem, I think, with Mr. Osterhaus's affidavit, because he says, well, they didn't get this, they didn't get this, they didn't get that. And the problem is those things were not available to us. And I think it's misleading for him to sort of suggest that there was a formal process for us to go through. There wasn't. We've met with the Railroad Commission 3 times, and nobody has ever told us not to enforce our regulations. Nobody has ever told us that they are all preempted and wiped out and that we can't enforce them. In fact, they have told us exactly the opposite. And Ms. Chang's and Mr. Valenti's affidavits say exactly the same thing. So putting the burden on Houston to sort of come up with some way to assert its rights when the Railroad Commission has not done so, and when TPGA has not gone to the Railroad Commission, filed a mandamus, and said, get those regulations out, that's where the burden of proof lies. It doesn't lie on us to say, well, we did this thing and we did that thing. In our mootness section, we have tried to suggest that what we have done is basically what was available to us, and so we have done everything we could to get the permission that we needed. And so the court sort of has a choice between those two. If it says that there's not a procedure, the risk is borne by the RRC and by TPGA. If it says, well, city got what it got and what it could get, then the case is moot. So either way, it should be dismissed.
But doesn't all of this just go to the merits of TPGA's claim and not our review of the summary judgment?
No, Your Honor, because I think it's a jurisdictional question. I mean, it is undisputed in this case that there is no process that the TPGA recognizes. That the Railroad Commission recognizes that we can satisfy and we can come into this court and say, "See, we did this," and everybody, including TPGA, has to satisfy it. Instead, they speculate that there is some Goldilocks solution that is informal, but it will get you formal approval. And so it puts a burden on cities to do something that they really are not able to do. I'd like to move, if the court is finished with that area, I'd like to move on to the criminal and civil, because I think that might be cleaner if the court is concerned that there might be some fact issue in here. I can't really see one because there is not a procedure. But I think this court should recognize, and I think particularly Justice Kelly, having worked in the criminal side of the docket, that claims like TPGA's alleging preemption of local law enforcement criminal penalties should proceed through the criminal courts. The Morales case could not be clearer. It says, quote, a civil court simply has no jurisdiction to render naked declarations of rights, status, or other legal relationships arising under a penal statute.
What is it that makes these penal statutes as opposed to administrative fines?
It's that they're enforced. Excuse me, I didn't mean to run over the court. It's that they're enforced through criminal fines in municipal court.
And who made that decision?
Houston made that decision.
So anytime a state has a regulation, couldn't the city just get around it by declaring that whatever regulation they want to pass, even though it conflicts with the state, is a criminal or penal ordinance?
Well, I guess technically that's possible. The problem is these are enforced criminally at the state level, too. That's how virtually all municipal regulations are enforced, be it, be it propane or be it another combustible liquid. That's just the way that these are enforced. The city doesn't really have a lot of other alternatives. Now, we have mentioned, for example, in the BCAG, they have a specific provision that talks about having to go and get permission that administrative or determination that administrative remedies are inadequate. But that's not something that that applies in these cases. So I guess in theory a city could do that, but I think they've got better things to do than try to figure out how to avoid state regulations. But nevertheless, even if they do that,
okay.
I think my time's expired if the court has no
I do have a question. So, and you've just mentioned criminal fines and mentioned in your brief criminal fines. So what makes something a criminal fine as opposed to an administrative fine?
I think it's enforced through the I mean, we have enforced through the municipal courts by our municipal attorneys. That's the really the way that we have to do it. We don't have cities are fairly lean, and they don't have a structure that would administratively allow us to do propane regulations here and electrical regulations here. So it's the way that we have structured it is within the fire code. It is not like the Leeper case where you've got one thing in one code and the enforcement provision elsewhere. Within the fire code, we have a bunch of offenses, and then we have how they're enforced. And they're enforced through criminal fines, including and can be the fire people can be firefighters can be assisted by the police force in enforcing those. So that's how cities do their work.
So and you're saying since these fines would be prosecuted or adjudicated, what have you, at a municipal court, that's what makes it a criminal fine.
Well, for example, I think in the BCCAAG case, that was a preemption case, and they focused specifically on the criminal enforcement provisions and said that's what we're having a problem with because there are state criminal enforcement provisions. And in the Unger case that we cite, which is a Railroad Commission case where they said almost exactly like they do here, we are, although there was a conviction there, someone is convicted under a anti-drilling ordinance, and the defense to the conviction is that the Railroad Commission regulations preempt it. That went through the Court of Criminal Appeals. What we're saying is not that they don't have a right to do it. It's just that they don't have a right to come in to civil court and do it unless they meet the one exception, which is if you show an irreparable injury to a vested property right, and that's something they never pleaded nor tried to prove.
And so is enforcement of the city's propane regulation solely through the Houston Fire Code, or is there any other way that they can enforce
it? I'm not aware of it if we do that. I think there might be there are notices of violation and steps that are taken, but ultimately the fines are, and they're small fines, are done through the municipal courts because that's how it's basically done in city government. And so in the fire code contains criminal penalties, and those things have to be read together. The Unger case, the destructors case says that, and in fact, even the Leeper case specifically says that if one part of the, even if the education code defines the elements of the prescribed offense, that and that was the basis for enforcement under the criminal provisions, then both could be considered criminal. And so the Texas Supreme Court, I think, has made the decision for you. That's at page 442 of the Leeper case that's cited in our brief at page 24. So I think they've made that decision.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Good morning, Ms. Weber.
Good morning. May it please the court. This court should affirm the trial court's denial of the City of Houston's plea to the jurisdiction because this is the correct proceeding in the correct court to resolve the question of whether the City of Houston's regulations regarding the LP gas industry are preempted by Texas Railroad Commission regulations. The Texas Propane Gas Association has associational standing. The claims are neither unripe nor moot, and the claims here do not run afoul of jurisdictional limits regarding the application of penal statutes in civil proceedings. Now, the merits of the preemption claim are not directly at issue in this interlocutory appeal, but I think that clarifying what the claims actually are, what we're actually saying, what the preemption statute actually provides, can be helpful in analyzing the jurisdictional challenges, including specifically the standing issue. So I filed earlier this week a set of oral argument exhibits, and then I hope you have up there, I gave to the clerk this morning, bound sets. that I'd like to go through. And if you turn first to tab one, this has gathered some of the relevant provisions from chapter 113 of the Natural Resource Code. And this is the basis of the preemption claim. And you can see the bottom one is the preemption provision, 113.054. It has two sentences and only two sentences. The first sentence is the preemption provision. It says, shall preempt and supersede any ordinance by a local subdivision relating to any aspect or phase of the liquefied petroleum gas industry. The second sentence provides an exception that you can do, a city can go to the Railroad Commission and petition and get an exception to let them bring in their others. And it is our position that this plain language of the first sentence is a blanket prohibition. It is a blanket preemption of all of the regulations, all of the Houston ordinances that regulate LP gas, all of them, not just to the extent of a conflict, but all of them. The neutron bomb that Ms. Petty referred to, it's the first sentence of 113.054. And if you flip to tab two, I've gathered some preemption provisions from different statutes, state statutes, and you can see sometimes a preemption provision requires a conflict with a local ordinance, between a local ordinance and state law, and sometimes it doesn't. For example, any ordinance relating to over-the-counter sales of ephedrine, preempted. Any ordinance relating to sales distribution of fertilizer, preempted. Anything related to LP gas, preempted. Then you look at some others. Some other provisions say if it's contrary, if there's a conflict, if it's inconsistent. So the neutron bomb is our interpretation, is the appropriate interpretation of that first sentence. Now, again, that's the merits, but it's helpful to know what we're getting at. So
can I ask, while you're kind of making the distinction between the jurisdictional questions and the merits, one thing I noticed is that the appellants and appellees' prayers don't necessarily match up, because the appellants have essentially a summary judgment that was denied as well as a pleaded jurisdiction. It was one document, and I noticed that you all in your prayer only ask us to affirm the decision as to the pleaded jurisdiction and don't seem to mention the summary judgment. So what's...
Well, the procedurally, there were cross motions for summary judgment, right, and plea to the jurisdiction by the City of Houston. The trial court issued an order that denied all of them, denied both sides of summary judgment, and denied the plea to the jurisdiction. Only the denial of the plea to the jurisdiction is amenable to an interlocutory appeal. So that is the only ruling by the trial court that's before you. If we had, for example, gotten the bells and whistles of a permissive appeal, and the legal question presented as part of a permission by the trial court to let that come up, then the merits would be in front of you. But procedurally, the only ruling that is before you is the denial of the City of Houston's plea to the jurisdiction, and we ask that you affirm that.
Gotcha. I guess I'm so used to seeing everyone bootstrap their summary judgment along with the plea that...
You know, and here we are following the parameters of the court's interlocutory jurisdiction.
Throws us off when you do that.
Silly us.
Thanks for that clarification.
Silly us. But the... moving from the background, so that's the landscape in which the jurisdictional questions arise, the standing, the penal provision, that's the background in which they arise. And regarding I'd like to speak first about the penal issue, if that's all right with the court. And I want to talk big picture and then two specifics. From a big picture standpoint, in analyzing the scope of this doctrine, this court and the Texas Supreme Court have recognized that this doctrine is not governed by absolute bright lines. The analysis of this jurisdictional issue, it presents gray. It presents nuance. And the court's guidance makes plain that it has no application here in this case. The Supreme Court in the Heckman case held that the penal jurisdictional limitation did not apply, even though that case involved the question of whether people charged with misdemeanor criminal charges were entitled to court-appointed counsel. How could something be more penal-related than that? And yet the court said, you look to determine whether a matter really is a criminal proceeding, you look at the essence of the case to determine whether the issues it entails are more substantively criminal or civil. So Heckman tells us there's nuance here. You don't just look and say, oh, there's a penal statute, I'm done. This court, in the TABC versus American Legion court that this court decided a few years ago, Chief Justice Rose, I think you wrote that opinion about the an American Legion post that was using some gambling, a sweepstakes, and the question was whether that ran afoul of criminal provisions regulated by the TABC. And this court said in that TABC case two important things for purposes of analyzing the gray, the fact that this doctrine has gray in it. First, the court said, quote, Morales did not create an absolute bar to the construction of a criminal statute by a court exercising its civil jurisdiction. It is not an absolute bar. Just because something smells like a penal provision doesn't limit the court's jurisdiction per se. And second, the TABC court recognized that the Supreme Court frequently interprets and construes criminal statutes when those provisions are incorporated into or implicated in civil statutes or regulations, and thus recognizes that there's gray and there's nuance in where you draw the line, and all of which leads to the Texas Supreme Court's two most recent cases involving preemption of local ordinances by state statute, the BCCA versus City of Houston case and the City of Laredo versus Laredo Merchants Association, decided in 2016 and 2018. And those two cases were our exact procedural posture. Both of them were lawsuits brought by trade associations under associational standing principles in order to invalidate a city ordinance that had penalties in the same dollar numbers, in the bag ban case, same dollar number, up to $2,000 per violation per day as the LPG ordinances that are issue here, a declaratory judgment brought by the trade association to declare the city ordinances invalid because they are preempted by state law. Now, if Ms. Petty is correct, the City of Houston is correct, that these are plain vanilla Morales, they're outside of the jurisdiction of the courts, then neither the BCCA opinion nor the City of Laredo bag ban were within the subject matter jurisdiction of the Supreme Court of Texas when it decided those two cases. Now, this issue of the penal limitation on jurisdiction was briefed to the Supreme Court in both of those cases by the City of Houston, was briefed in both of those cases. The court didn't address it at all in the BCCA opinion. Just blew by it. Doesn't bother us. We're okay. Did address it in the City of Laredo case, addressed it, and dismissed it, and said, no, we don't have a problem with it. We've got jurisdiction here. The court determined it and analyzed the issue and said it has subject matter jurisdiction. Now, the issue was brought up by the City of Houston in the Laredo bag ban case, not by any of the parties. But that doesn't make it dicta, and here's why. It is subject matter jurisdiction. There is nothing more fundamental to a court's determination. A court can always, even sua sponte, address subject matter jurisdiction. The court addressed it, whether prompted by an amicus, its own self, or a party. The court addressed it, analyzed it, and that is the operative law. That is what the Supreme Court has told us regarding the applicability of the penal limitation on jurisdiction in cases like this. We're exactly like the bag ban case, we're exactly like BCCA, and this court should do exactly, the trial court did exactly like the Supreme Court did in those two cases. And so that's my big picture. Now here are my two specifics. One is the question, Justice Kelly, you were asking, how do we know this is penal? What makes this penal? Well, I've got a couple of responses on that. Again, in my little booklet, at tab 3, We've got Chapter 61 from the Houston Code, and this does nothing but regulate LP gas. Has all kinds of regulations, and you can have this size tank, and you can't put it on this kind of motorhome. And there's nothing in here. There's nothing. There's no mention. There's nothing about any kind of penalty. It just says you should get a permit. Portable gas, LP gas containers can only be this size. Then if you turn to tab 4, we have some excerpts from, and all these are in the record. You can see the Bates numbering from the clerk's record citations. Tab 4 has some provisions from the fire code. These are enforcement provisions. And these set out all of the, here's the fine for this, the penalty for that. And if you turn to the very, very last page of tab 4, which is numbered 19 or 333 at the bottom, at the very top is the provision regarding penalties, and it's not less than $500 nor more than $2,000 per violation per day. Like I said before, that's the exact same dollar number of the penalty that was at issue in the Laredo Bag Ban case. So what we're asking this court to do on the merits is to determine that this Chapter 61 is preempted by state statute, but leave this, the various sort of generic, generally applicable, widely applicable penalty provisions, leaves those untouched.
So is it TPGA's contention that nothing in Chapter 61 is criminal?
Correct. And if you look at state statutes that have the ordinances that have been analyzed in the preemption context, for purposes of whether they're penal or not, the courts have, a lot of those ordinances on their face, in their inherent structure, are penal. For example, in the Laredo Bag Ban case, the ordinance said it shall be unlawful for any commercial establishment to give out this kind of bag. And in the same paragraph said violations of the provisions of this ordinance is a Class C misdemeanor. In the BCCA case, the Texas Supreme Court described the Houston ordinances that it was preempting as the what Houston did there was take what was primarily an administrative and civil enforcement regime under state law into a primarily criminal enforcement regime under the ordinances.
But nowhere in Chapter 61 or these provisions of the fire code does it say violation of this is a Class C misdemeanor. I mean, isn't the language very generic? It says general penalty, continuing violations. In Section 109, there's a section that's been struck that says shall be guilty of a specific offense, punishable by a fine of not more than so many dollars or imprisonment not exceeding number of days. Isn't that the criminal, the type of criminal language that you're talking about in this bag ban case? This is a Class C misdemeanor, or this is a...
And it's not even in the Chapter 61, is my main point. It's in a different chapter entirely. The bag ban case had it in the same sentence. The city of New Braunfels, the cooler ordinance that this court analyzed in the Stop the Ordinances cases, that one said it shall be unlawful to carry a cooler of a certain size. The State versus Morales case said a person commits an offense, and that was in the penal code. The Destructors case said it shall be unlawful. So all of the ordinances that have been at issue analyzed under this doctrine have been addressing a situation where the ordinance itself bakes in something penal, and we don't have that here. We're asking you to, ultimately on the merits, to find preempted regulations that say nothing about any fines.
I have a kind of off the charts question on this. I seem to recall when I was on the district bench that the distinction between civil and criminal in Travis County is sort of an administrative one, but not a jurisdictional, i.e. the Travis County civil courts actually have full jurisdiction over criminal and civil. Has anybody looked at that, or does that play in our decision on this?
Some of the case law construing this jurisdictional doctrine have clarified that where a court has both jurisdiction, a civil proceeding versus a criminal proceeding would have similar jurisdictional limitations. And so I wish that were a silver bullet for me, Your Honor, but I can't claim it. So that's
I learned that one the hard way, by the way.
That's my first specific point, is this is not a penal statute. The ordinance that we are asking you to strike down is not a penal ordinance. My second specific point is turning to the Laredo bag ban case. The court in the Laredo bag ban case, honestly, this could not be more on direct all fours for our purposes, for both associational standing analysis and for this penal jurisdiction limit. Footnote number 28, the court analyzed jurisdiction in response to the City of Houston's amicus brief, and the court found that the claims didn't run afoul of the penal jurisdiction thing because the merchants would suffer an irreparable injury to their vested property rights because at $2,000 per violation per day, a small business cannot afford to violate the law, take the criminal hit, and then challenge the law challenge the ordinance in a criminal proceeding as a defensive measure. Now, the court made that determination based solely on the fact that the ordinance called for $2,000 per violation per day fine. There was no pleading of irreparable injury to a vested property right. There was no proof of an irreparable injury to a vested property right because none of the parties challenged it. Only the City of Houston challenged it in an amicus brief. And what the Supreme Court of Texas told us in footnote number 28 is that on its face, irreparable injury to a vested property right can be determined. Now, there's a different, and that is directly applicable here because the structure of the statute is the same. The individual who would be violating the propane regulations, the members of the association, are the people who would be facing the fine. That's a direct application of the fine to the members of this association. And in that way, it's different from the New Braunfels cooler ordinance. That case, in those cases, this court analyzed in a pretty deep fashion whether or not the irreparable injury to vested property rights applies and determined that it didn't, but that was an indirect situation because what was regulated was coolers on the river, whereas the individual outfitters, I can sell my coolers all I want, it's just someone can't take it on the river, and the court said, no, we can't say that you're suffering the vested property right, but that's not our situation. We are exactly like the Laredo bag ban case.
So you're saying just the threat of a $2,000 fine per day is your irreparable injury to your vested property rights?
Exactly, Your Honor. Exactly, Your Honor. So those are the big picture, two specifics. We submit that this court ought to affirm the district court's denial of the plea to the jurisdiction on that penal issue because of how you look at this. This isn't a penal statute, and we come into the exception just exactly like the Laredo bag ban.
In your little picture scenario, you went through kind of the second prong of the irreparable injury. The first prong, does that require us to get into the merits to look at whether this is unconstitutional? Is
no, Your Honor.
The preemption question?
You do not need to determine preemption. It's just the sort of claim that is at issue here. And if I may, I know I've run out of my time, but if I may very briefly address.
Give a little extra, that's fine.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address the question of the whether or not this is ripe because there is not a formal petition procedure. In the Railroad Commission, and the answer is no, and here's why. So the statute, 113.054, has two sentences. First sentence preempts. Second sentence says it's an exception. If you want to have one of your more restrictive ordinances be valid, you can petition. For purposes of the ripeness jurisdictional analysis, the only question is whether the first sentence has been implemented. Now, if the Railroad Commission had never adopted the LPG safety rules that it did, as Chapter 9 in 16 Administrative Code. If the Railroad Commission had never adopted that code, then sentence 1 would never have been implemented. There would not be Railroad Commission regulation of the LPG industry that then preempts the city ordinances. Then we'd have a ripeness problem. The fact that the Railroad Commission has not adopted a formal procedure for the second part of 054 doesn't keep the first part from being implemented for a few reasons. One, the only thing that's needed for the first one is the adoption of Railroad Commission regs, and that's been done. Second, there is not a necessity, there is not a requirement or a mandate or even a practical need for there to be a formal petition process. The City of Houston hasn't done everything it could in order to get the consent of the Railroad Commission because they have never petitioned the Commission's executive director. They went and had a meeting, which the Railroad Commission director of LP Gas said, at the meeting, we never told them that they could keep theirs in place. So the idea that the Railroad Commission said, go forth, you're good, we're okay with not preempting, that's simply factually not true. But the City of Houston can do those things, can petition the executive director of the Railroad Commission, and they haven't done so.
Ms. Weber, if I could, you've referenced associational standing quite a bit, and I just have a question for you. So is it your position that under the associational standing that TPGA is required to present evidence of facts demonstrating all of your membership has standing, just some members, one member? What's your position on that?
One or more. State law says one or more. I have to show that one or more of my members would have standing to sue in their own right. And I've done that, and then some. It's included in the record. The petition, our Fourth Amendment petition, has factual recitals, and we included several affidavits. In particular, if you look at the Joe Green affidavit that appears at page something of the record, that 217 of the record, and there's a factual discussion regarding a project at 5601 H. Mark Croswell Jr. Street, and the fact that they had to pay extra fines and they were subject to City of Houston regulations, and that satisfies the associational standing. And once again, just like on the penal code thing, three words, Laredo Merchants Association. We are on all fours with that case regarding the jurisdictional issues, and we submit to the court that Judge Meacham did the right thing in denying the city's plea of the jurisdiction, and we urge the court to affirm that decision.
Thank you, Ms. Weber. Ms. Peddle, rebuttal.
Your Honor, TPGA cannot have it both ways. They can't say that their members have standing because they're under threat of criminal penalties, and then say for purposes of jurisdiction that these are not penal in nature, that the local fire codes are not penal in nature. It has to be one or the other, and yet they're trying to straddle both. I'd like to talk specifically about BCCAAG and Laredo. We make very specific reference in our brief, and I've made reference this morning, to the BCCAAG that has very peculiar provisions that require that a person in a locality trying to do criminal enforcement has to go to a state agency, give them the first crack, have a determination made that administrative remedies are inadequate, and then they go, then they may enforce it penally. That is why I think the Supreme Court denied our motion for rehearing, which, as this court knows, has no binding effect. So BCCAAG is not on point here. And frankly, nor is Laredo, because I think that Laredo, frankly, supports us. What Laredo did was to state the Morales rule and reaffirm it, and said that you have to have irreparable injury to a vested property right. It was not only not pleaded here, And this was not an amicus brief. This was in a case where we raised this issue below. It was not only not pleaded here, but they made no effort to do it. There is not yet a vested property right that they have identified that was lost here. The affidavits that they have don't even apply to the codes that they challenged. They applied to the building code and to the plumbing code. One of the other affidavits they have is a customer, and there's no principle of associational standing that allows you to deal with a customer. And the last one, she makes reference to fines. There are no fines. There was no enforcement at all. In fact, all they did was not get the benefits that they expected. So there is no injury in the jurisdictional record here. So that's not anything that they've had here. What the court did in Laredo then was to find a vested property right somehow in this ability to use non-compliant bags. I'm not going to say that that's a good idea, but at least the court found one. They've not even tried to assert one here. Second, they said that the ordinance imposes a substantial personal violation that effectively precludes local businesses from testing the ban's constitutionality in a defense to criminal prosecution. They've not even suggested that that's the case. In fact, as an association, they want to go forth. They have never said that their members, you know, would not go forward. The case that's cited, frankly, in Laredo, and I think probably miscited, is the Austin Cemetery case, which says that when people have to bury their mama in town, and they might risk digging her up if you violate an ordinance that says that you can't bury people in the city of Austin, that means that people are not going to test the ordinance that way. So I think that the Laredo court, frankly, overread it, but in any case, there's been no attempt at compliance here. So this case is nothing like the Laredo bag ban case. What you're finding is that TPGA wants to come in here and try to, after the fact, retrofit this case, because TGPA admitted that the fire code enforcement was through penal codes. I'd like to go back then and talk about some specific things that she talked about. The idea, this sort of fantasy that TPGA has, that Houston could have done all of these things. There was no process that has yet been identified. You look back in the briefs, you look back in the motions, they have never said, here is the process that Houston should have used, and if they had used that, we would have been satisfied. Instead, they've said, there's something out there, and if they said, Mother, may I, maybe that would have worked. But Mr. Valenti has, and that is not something that's far after Mr. Osterhaus's affidavit. Mr. Valenti testifies, I think, very clearly that nobody at the Railroad Commission has ever said that there was anything more that we needed to do that we're not doing. So they've never outlined a procedure. Second, they want to talk about a blanket prohibition, and so that somehow makes their claim need to have a showing of particularized injury, or it somehow gets around the criminal thing. But the Railroad Commission itself, in its proposed rules, does not embrace that. This court has to give some deference to that interpretation. And in fact, they even go beyond that. They want to talk about the plumbing code. The Texas Constitution doesn't give the state authority to do these kind of blanket prohibitions. And there's been no showing that even if it was a blanket provision, how this court would draft an order, because it would have to have each of the provisions that was preempted. So they need to show, under the Bennett case that we cited, they need to show a particularized injury for each of those preempted statutes, and they've not done that. In fact, they haven't shown any injury at all.
Do you agree that the Hunt test, the Supreme Court's Hunt test that was in our Texas Supreme Court's decision in the Texas Association of Business versus Texas Air Control Board, is the correct standard for evaluating associational standing in this case?
I think it is, but I don't think it goes on enough with this. I agree that you only need a one or two members, but I think the problem here is what they want to say is that if I am a member and I have standing for 1.21, that means I have standing to challenge the entire fire code. And so what we're saying is, yeah, they have standing to challenge whatever it is, although they have never mentioned in any of their affidavits the specific provisions of the fire code. They've talked about the plumbing code. They've talked about the building code. So our position is, yeah, you get to match up your injury with a claim that that particular provision is preempted. But what you don't get to do is say, I have one provision here, and I then get to challenge the entire fire code on a blanket basis. So we agree on general topics of associational standing, but not on that. My time's expired if you don't have any questions.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Petty. Thank you, Ms. Weber. Fun, vigorous argument on an interesting case. Case will be submitted. Court will stand in recess. Thank you.
Thank you.